This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
This episode is brought to you by Amazon Prime. You know Amazon Prime is not just a shipping subscription, right? It's got everything, including streaming TV and movies on Prime Video. And of course, Prime's fast, free shipping. Go from watching your favorite shows to getting your favorite things. Whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Visit amazon.com/prime to get more out of whatever you're into.
If you're thinking, I should go for a run today, but it looks like it could rain, Sierra says save on epic rain jackets. If you're also thinking, but I can't go out in these beat-up old running shoes, Sierra says, save on top-brand running shoes. And if you're still thinking, but I'm also busy performing brain surgery, well, then we say, you really should have led with that. Sierra, let's get moving to your local store, like now. Go!
Hello, welcome to Instant Genius, a bite-sized masterclass in podcast form. I'm Jason Goodger, commissioning editor at BBC Science Focus magazine. Have you ever wondered what's happening in your body and brain when you feel an emotion? Or how about how to better cope with negative ones? Or why we even have them in the first place? It turns out the answers to these questions aren't as straightforward as they might first seem. In this episode, I speak to neuroscientist and author Dr. Dean Burnett. He tells me about the surprising discoveries underpinning emotions that he made when writing his new book, Emotional Intelligence. Okay, so we're talking about emotions, and in the first chapter of the book, you encounter the problem that there isn't really an agreed definition of exactly what an emotion is. Why is it so hard to pin down the definition?
Yeah, it's a really, again, it was a big issue when I first started writing the book, the first draft. I mean, the book was originally meant to be a breezy and fun overview of the science of emotions, which I had been led to believe was well established and understood, which is not the case at all. Yeah, there's lots of different factors which play into this, and it sort of relates to how, like, I'm a behavioral neuroscientist by training. That was my PhD in the behavioral neuroscience lab in Cardiff. And you know, although it surprised a lot of people, that sort of discipline, you essentially, although you're trying to study the brain, you ignore the mind. Because although it's like the most important part from by most people's perspectives, it's really hard to study, nigh on impossible, because you know it's got no objective parameters. We don't have any way to assess it or analyze or measure it or weigh it, or you know, it's not tangible in that respect. And the same thing applies to emotions too. Like, we all recognize them and we also appreciate them and are aware of them, but it's really hard to write down what exactly they are. You know, it's almost like art in that respect. As in, everyone, yeah, that's art, but you know, where does the art and junk end? What's the parameters? What's the boundary? It's all very subjective. So it's a big part of that. Like, emotions are variable and intangible in many ways. So being able to, you know, assess them and find a robust definition is tricky. And you know, in terms of how the brain works, emotions don't really have one thing. I think it's a very common question we're getting asked a lot lately, is where in the brain do emotions come from? And I've realized that's tantamount about the saying, where on earth does air come from? So, well, it comes from lots of places. You know, it's not one thing. Like, there's lots of different factors, and it's a huge elaborate process. And it's very similar here. You know, some parts produce more than others, like the oceans and the rainforests, they produce more oxygen. But that doesn't mean nothing else does, and there are other parts are involved. So when you experience an emotion, is there just like one raw neurological aspect, which is the pure emotion? Or should the expression of emotion be taken into account? Should the reaction to it? Should the sensory aspect which led to it? Should the physical reactions which stem from it, are they part of the emotion? Are they not? And that's all sort of a big part of the discussion. And you know, it's because they've been so fundamental to our very existence for so long, I think people don't realize that just because something's familiar doesn't mean it's easy or simple. And I fell into that trap really early on. So yeah, there's lots of different definitions to it. Like I think in the book, I say emotions, like saying farm animals. Everyone knows what that is, and they know what is and isn't one. But if you had to define a farm animal in the technical sense, like you have to dissect a pig, you'd struggle just by going with farm animal. And so because they have so many different properties, and like where they begin and end is still hotly debated. So defining them is hard to do.
So with that said, Ben, how do we actually go about studying emotions? You know, what do all these neuroscientists and psychologists actually do?
Yeah, well, the study of emotions neuroscientifically is usually labelled affective neuroscience, affect. So scientists have this term called affect, which is basically a way of describing the experience of having an emotion. You know, something is happening when we experience an emotion, and affect is the label we attach to that something. Now, there is a school of thought now which suggests that affect is like the raw building block of emotional experience. And our brains take this affect like a pot of wood clay and shape it into something which we recognize as an emotion as and when we need. So like this is the constructivist view of emotions. So there's some people argue, you know, for a very long time, and still in many cases, it's was believed that there are basic emotions, like the bedrock of emotion is the fundamental emotional keys on a piano. Like, you know, you can... These are the ones which are the baseline, and everything's built up around these. So fear, anger, surprise, disgust, these were considered to be basic emotions. But now there's a rival school of thought, rival model, which suggests that no, what we have is affect. The brain produces an emotional reaction to whatever happens to us, and then uses this to say, right, in this case, we need to be experiencing fear, and this is a bad thing, and we want to get away from it. So now the brain generates a fear response. So in this case, this is an injustice. We need to generate an anger response, and it's also tweaked and modified in each case according to what's needed. Which is obviously a different approach, isn't it? Like there is no such thing as a fundamental emotion in this regard. It's all just very familiar and constantly used ones. So yeah, but you can still study the neurological activity that's happening in the brain, like given how brain scanners work. So someone has an emotional experience, you can see what's happening in their brain. So like, oh, when they experience this, if it's fear, like they're clearly scared, they're saying they're scared, we would see activity in the amygdala, which is like obviously one of the emotional hubs in the brain involved a lot of emotional related processes. But if someone is experiencing disgust or looking at a disgusting sight, being told a disgusting story, they usually see increased activity in the insular cortex, which is a different part of the brain. So boom, that does lend credence to the idea that there are neurological fundamental basics of emotions. So they've got that sort of discipline there. But again, there's also data which, like things like happiness, it doesn't seem to have any one particular bit which causes elevated activity in the brain. But also something like anger. Now, if you study someone being angry, you would see elevated activity in like the temporal lobe regions of the hypothalamus, which is to do with motivation. So like the anger makes us more motivated, as anyone who's been angry probably realizes. We want to do something about it, whether it's, it also suppresses our risk assessment sometimes. We will, if we're especially angry, we'll get stuck into something which we would normally avoid because like we just cannot abide letting this go. So like it's very motivational, but that's a different thing. So the part of the brain which handles motivation, like the hypothalamus and frontal lobe, is another complex process. That will be elevated when someone's angry, but that's not the part of the brain producing anger. That's being activated by the anger. So separating those two, is this a cause or an effect? That's a big part of it as well. So yeah, there's lots of ways to look at it. I mean, a lot of the most influential research was based on faces, like observing people's faces and recognizing the expression they're showing. Is this person happy? Is this person sad? And if you can recognize that, as many cultures can, it suggests that there is a direct neurological link between what's happening in the brain in emotion and what's happening in your face. So it's like the footprints of emotions, and you can get a lot of information from that. So there's lots of different things to be studied. And I think the more we study, the more closer we get to a set definition of emotions. But that's obviously... ideally, you'd have it the other way around, because then you could have people studying different things if they don't know what degrees what emotion is. But it is the situation we've got, and that's where people are working towards resolving it as best they can.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people have a tendency to kind of split their way of thinking into one part is emotion and one part is cognition. So thinking and feeling, and these are two independent processes. But as you explain in your book, that they're actually very intimately linked.
Yes, like I use the terms emotion and cognition in the book a lot to sort of to differentiate between what we would understand as these things. But at the most fundamental levels, at the neurological basics, there's a lot of intertwining. They're really sort of interdependent on each other. You know, it's widely agreed that rational thought, evolved out of emotion, much like a mushroom evolves from the stem, evolves, grows out of, and obviously emotions are the building blocks of thought in the evolutionary sense. We develop from there. Because you get a lot of primitive creatures which do seem to show what looks like emotion. As I say, primitive, more simple creatures. Everything obviously is as evolved as we are. So yeah, even in the evolutionary sense, there's a lot of overlap between the two. And for a while, it was believed that there was a neurological separation between thought and feelings, with the neocortex, the top complex part of the brain, being responsible for rational thought, the human stuff, the thinking, and the limbic system, the middle bit above the reptile brain but below the neocortex, being the emotional part. Also, all memories and reflexes and perceptions and emotions are generated. Again, more recent data, more complex research methods have revealed that is, once again, an oversimplification. There's a great deal of overlap between the two. And things like executive functioning, the ability to consciously control your actions, your thoughts, your feelings, and to stop yourself from doing things which are emotionally motivated. That is obviously something which suggests that our brain can control emotions with conscious thought, but executive functioning sort of develops as a result of emotions. So emotions happen and we think, okay, that happened and this was the consequence. Maybe I shouldn't do that again. And you learn from it that way. But also the emotions we end up developing and having are also produced the result of regular feedback and regular assessment of the outcome. Appraisal theory it is. So when you have an emotional response to something and then you consciously say, oh, well, that shouldn't have happened, or I don't like the fact that this happened, so next time this similar experience occurs, I will have a different emotional experience. So emotions shape our ability to think, and our thinking shapes our ability or our tendency to feel certain emotions. So there's a great deal of cognitive overlap. And also in the neurological sense, I think there was the anterior cingulate cortex. It was widely believed a long time that does have distinct channels or networks, which are one side for emotions, one side for rational thought. But again, more recent data suggests that there's overlap there as well. Like as in the rational can affect the emotional and the emotional can affect the rational. And I think in the book, one of the analogies I use is people think they were cognition and emotion are like two neighbors who share a fence and occasionally bicker and don't get on. But it's more like, a river split into two streams. At source, they have very, very similar or the same origins, just end up in different places. So it's probably a little more helpful to look at it like that in some respects, because the brain is never as simple as a binary divide would suggest.
So we've talked a lot about the brain there, but actually the brain influences the body and vice versa. So could you tell me a bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, in the emotional sense, this is almost the origins of emotion study. Chapter 1, it's talk about the Stoics, the ancient Greeks, who realized that emotions are things, distinct things with a physical presence in the world, because when we have an emotion, there's often a physical component to it as well. So when you're scared, your skin goes white because your blood rushes away. And when you're angry, you tense up and tremble, and when you're happy, you smile because you can't stop yourself, and you turn red, and embarrassment makes you red, and passion, all those things. So there's a definite physical component to a lot of familiar emotions, and that suggests that there's a link between what's happening in the brain and the body as well. But some schools of thought actually push it further, suggest that what's happening in the body is actually plays a bigger role in what emotions we feel than you'd expect. So the somatic marker hypothesis, which suggests that our brain recognizes our body is doing this combination of things, which means we need to produce the emotion of happiness, anger, fear, whatever you want to call it. I mean, that's it's not the most widely held model, but there's evidence suggests something like that is occurring. And again, just like with emotion and cognition in the cognitive sense, in the physical sense. People like myself regularly say brain and body as if they are, once again, two distinct things, like a pilot in a sort of big meat suit. But it's actually more like, you know, they're far more intertwined than that. There's a lot more overlap. There's no one near as distinct, because the brain is an organ and needs the body to survive, just like the body needs the brain to function as well. And so things like, you know, the endocrine system, the fact that, you know, your brain and other organs secrete hormones into your body, which usually induce an emotional response of some sort, shows that, you know, your body can influence what your brain is thinking. I mean, I think in anorexia, the loss of all the fatty adipose tissue means certain hormones aren't in the blood supply, which can further distort how your brain perceives the body and you know, the self-image and stuff. So, you know, that's a big part of that as well. And the vagus nerve is something which gets a lot of attention in the modern literature. It's the cranial nerve, like one of the 12 nerves that come from your brain stem and stuff and link to your head and upper body. But the vagus nerve is one that links to all the other organs. It's the big one. But it's mostly an enteric system, which means it's mostly receiving feedback from all your organs and relaying what's happening in those organs to the brain, like a really powerful broadband cable. But that means when something's gone wrong with your organs, or something's amiss, like a chemical imbalance, like they say, or disruption, or a kidney stone, something like that, your brain's very aware of it. Like before we consciously are, like we're not just feeling the pain, going, oh, that hurts. It's like your brain's getting updates on a regular basis from the, you know, the disruption to the organ, and, you know, reacts accordingly. So things like, you know, especially like the digestive system, like the gut-brain axis, that's a particularly key one, because obviously, as important as all organs are, the digestive system is where stuff enters the body. So it's like the gateway. And therefore, there's a lot of complex neurological systems to help regulate and monitor that. So things that go wrong in the stomach and intestines, you know, the brain's very attuned to that via the vagus nerve. And so if your stomach is, you know, if your diet or your gut bacteria are causing problems, the brain recognizes that and says, oh, something's wrong, something's wrong, something's wrong. And therefore, you get anxiety, depression, or like just general stress. So like a lot of new therapies for treating mental health problems like depression are focusing on the vagus nerve or the gut, which doesn't know objectively, if you first hear that, you're thinking, how does that even work? How does some problem in your brain get helped by, you know, changing your gut bacteria? But that's how, because, you know, your brain recognizes something's going wrong with your body, and at the subconscious emotional level responds to it. And obviously, so your cognition is twittering away up top, just like oblivious, and you're suddenly developing these feelings and bad moods and stuff. So, yeah, so the body is a huge part to play in both the experience and expression of emotions too. So, yeah, relaying emotional cues to others, a lot of that is body language. As the cliche goes, like only 10% of communication is verbal. A lot of it is how your body is behaving in ways which convey an emotional message to the wider world.
Life is a highway. And on it, there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
This episode is brought to you by Amazon Prime. You know Amazon Prime is not just a shipping subscription, right? It's got everything, including streaming TV and movies on Prime Video. And of course, Prime's fast, free shipping. Go from watching your favorite shows to getting your favorite things. Whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Visit amazon.com/prime to get more out of whatever you're into.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
So you mentioned there about expressing emotions. So you mentioned facial expressions. So what do we know about facial expression? Are there universal facial expressions found over the entire human race to express emotions?
Well, that was the sort of the assumption, or not the belief even. Let's go further than that. Throughout much of the emotion research world, thanks to the work of Paul Ekman in the 70s, and it was believed to be definitive. Like that's one thing everyone agrees on, that the facial expressions are universal throughout all cultures. and therefore the emotions are too. So it's not like before then, for his work, it was genuinely agreed that people learn facial expressions like we learn the language we grow up to speak. And we have language processing parts of the brain, like your Broca's area, your Wernicke's and stuff, but those are like the hardware, which needs to be programmed. And as we grow up, we're surrounded by English, French, German-speaking parents, family, community, and that's the language we speak. We're not born speaking it, and people thought the same thing applied to facial expressions. But then Paul Ekman's work with like indigenous tribes and remote cultures revealed that they have very similar facial expressions to the wider world, and therefore, well, they haven't learned from anyone else, therefore they must be universal. And that was the dominant belief in, or the dominant model in emotion research for a very long time, and still is in many respects, in ways which are actually becoming unhelpful. It's like a later chapter, but like a lot of software and algorithms which are programmed to recognize people's emotions from a distance are based on this idea that your facial expressions are, you know, emotional and universal across all cultures and all people. And modern research says that might not be right. That's actually not necessarily the case. I mean, there's an element of that, but even amongst the, you know, the communities which agree that your emotions are, you know, effectively portrayed by your face universally and consistently amongst people and cultures, there's debate there as well. Like, for example, not all emotions are corresponded. Not all emotions have a corresponding facial expression. Like, what does someone who is experiencing satisfaction, if that's an emotion, what's their face look like? I mean, you can speculate, but it's not consistent. Or pride. Or what's the expression when it says guilt? Like, this is a powerful emotion, but there's no one expression which everyone goes, oh, that's a guilty person. I know that face. So there are like quiet emotions or silent emotions or invisible, whatever you want to call them. But also some people run sort of deep analysis of all the different micro expressions you can have and found that actually, like fear and anger have a very similar facial expression at the fine granular level. So we should count those as one. So now there's only four expressions, not seven, not six. But then later research suggests that although even if people do have, you know, a consistent facial reaction, and it might be consistent across cultures, not everyone shows the exact same expression. Like there's no one expression that everyone has for happiness. Like you can recognize it, but you know, you can recognize like a pet, but not every pet is the same, and you understand the concept of it. But when people are made to sort of like look at facial expressions and given a choice of like, is this person happy, sad, depressed, angry, they can get it right like 99% of the time. If you do candid shots, or like someone who's not putting an exaggerated expression for the camera, or don't give them options, saying what emotion is this person experiencing, then our ability to recognize it falls through the floor, because like it's like 25, 30, 40% compared to 90-odd, because, you know, it's not just the face. Like the face is a big part of it, but more and more now it's become accepted that the context is essential too, because if someone's got a certain expression, like said, oh, they're happy, like you can see the big smiley face and stuff, and they pan back and they've been given a birthday present, they go, yep, I was right. You pan back and someone's got a knife at them. Like, oh, no, actually, they're terrified and they don't know what to do. And like, so, yeah, the wider context is way more important than the initial theories about universal facial expressions would have suggested. But nonetheless, a lot of very important, influential organizations and systems have adopted this idea that you can tell someone's emotion from their face alone and integrated it into their operating system or the security system. And that's not great. That's unhelpful, and that's going to cause problems if it hasn't already.
So sticking with expressing emotions, probably the most overt expression of emotion is crying. I'd never really thought about this before, but you know, when you're sad or you're in pain, water comes out of your eyes. But the more I think about that, the stranger it is. So what do we know about crying and the response to emotion?
Yeah, well, crying is probably the most classic example of emotions have a physical component. You know, it's an actual expulsion from your body. That and laughter, you know, when you're amused, you laugh. It's a big, aggressive, over-the-top physical manifestation of an emotional state. But crying is obviously another one. And I think, it's one of those things, everyone recognizes it, or babies cry. Obviously, it's a very fundamental reflex, but it's, way more complex than you'd perhaps anticipate, because like there are three types of tears. Like your basal tears, which just keep your eyes wet on a day-to-day basis, minute by minute. Your reflex tears, which you get onion vapor or dust in your eye, like you're just like trying to flush it out. But psychoemotive tears, the tears we experience when we have an emotional reaction to things, are actually chemically different to the other two. They contain things like oxytocin or certain endorphins or certain hormones, which aren't produced when we cry because of onions or whatever it is. And that suggests, oh, the emotional reaction we're having is causing a chemical response in our body, a chemical change in our physical output. Also, like, what's the benefit? Why would we evolve the ability to leak water from our eyes when in an intense emotional state? Usually sadness, but I know some people who cry because they're angry. You know, they don't want to cry. They're not sad, but it's just like a reflex. They can't seem to help. Or people cry with laughter or cry because they're overwhelmed by happiness. You know, it's a weirdly broad physical response to an emotional state. And there's arguments that it's actually it's a cue. It's like, so other people around us, because we are such a social communicative species, like, and sharing our emotional state is a big part of just default existence. Our brains do it all the time, as do our bodies. So when someone's in an intense emotional state and they start leaking water from their eyes, that's a sign for those around them to say, oh, this person is in an extreme emotional state. I can either A, help, obviously they're in distress, or B, join in. If they're happy tears, and like, you want to share that happiness. You want to say, oh, what's the big deal? What's going on? Why are you so pleased? And can I have some? Can I have some happiness, please? And that's it's a useful emotional trait. But that even that doesn't really suggest why the chemical differences. So there's some arguments that when we cry, we excrete like oxytocin and stuff, which absorbs into our skin, and we become sort of more emotionally open, so other people can help us, and we can share, you know, our state with others. Or it's because they might evaporate, and then the other people around us can, you know, there are emotions in the air, but via the form of oxytocin and other social hormones, so people inhale and become more emotionally available, enhances their emotional connection to you. It's a theory. It's a tricky one to sort of prove conclusively, but they have done studies where people have inhaled other people's tears and have had different emotional responses to certain stimuli. It's unlikely to say, you know, it helps you that much, because your tears are full of emotional hormones and they absorb by your skin. It's a very indirect and inefficient way of doing it when your brain just produces this stuff anyway, you know, just instantly. It's a lot easier to drop it in your own bloodstream than go via the outer skin. But so it could be just a way of bonding and connecting with other people when you're emotionally vulnerable or emotionally stimulated, in order to shore up connections with others or maybe get their assistance. So that's one, that's the main theory that I've heard about that.
So I'm one of those people that cries quite easily. So I'll often describe films as like a seven crier or something. But even though it seems like a negative experience, like, I'll deliberately watch sad films, I'll deliberately listen to sad music that makes me cry. So what do we know about, you know, I'm not alone in that. What do we know about why people do that?
Yeah, that's something which was confusing to me too, because obviously the book was written from my perspective when my father died from COVID, and I was like struggling with the grief in isolation because of lockdown. So I was exploring a lot of my own emotions, and also some of the log jams I had, because I wasn't an easy crier before this happened. I'm far more so now, because I'm less emotionally ignorant, hence the title of the book. And because I was dead a head full of confused emotions, I was sort of using sad things, like sad entertainment, as a sort of emotional nicotine patch to sort of make sure I did cry a bit. I'm a big fan of Pixar films, and they're very good at that, and sort of finding the particular moment which just causes you to break down a bit. And that's but when you're looking for entertainments which make you sad or make you cry, you're pretty much spoiled for choice, which objectively is sort of counterintuitive. Because nobody wants to be sad. We don't like to be sad. It's a negative emotion. We try to avoid it. Same with anger. Same with fear. But there are loads of entertainments out there which are designed to produce these exact emotional states. And if you have people who act in sad films, they're more likely to win awards than someone who does a comedy. And that's just, we ascribe a lot of value to the ability to make people sad or experience negative emotions. And a lot of that, it turns out, is because we are, as people, we are kind of fixated with being happy. We do things we can to make ourselves happier, or at least avoid stress and stuff like that. So we avoid negative emotions where we can. But that's not necessarily the best approach when it comes to a healthy brain and well-being. So when you experience a negative emotion, it's novel, which your brain likes anyway. But if it's in a safe context, if it's in a situation where like it's not affecting you directly, aside from the emotional being experienced, so it's not like a situation which, you know, negatively impacts on your life, and you have control over it, that means your brain gets to experience an emotion it doesn't normally get to, which means your brain becomes better at processing and handling that emotional state for later use. And, you know, it's like it's basically like taking your mind to the gym. I say, right, okay, I don't normally get to do fear, so let's watch a scary film. Yeah. Fire up the fear system, then you know, the brain goes, okay, this is how you handle fear. Okay, I've got some good practice with that. But it's not actually scary in the sense of, it's not happening to me, and I can turn this off or leave the cinema whenever I want, put the book down. I remain full control. I'm just indulging myself in this emotional state. And you see that people who like listen to sad music or like who regularly indulge in sad films, they are better able to handle sad situations when they happen for real. Similar data, which I've always liked, is that, you know, heavy metal fans, you know, chronic and persistent heavy metal fans who love it, despite what your appearances and stereotypes may suggest, they tend to be the least angry people. Like they are the hardest to make angry, and they handle things a lot more passively and calmly because the music they listen to and they love induces anger in them on a regular basis. So their brain has the ability to go, right, this is supposed to make me angry. I know what anger is like. I'm just going to, yep, file that away. Don't worry about it. You know, I'm on top of that. And that's what these entertainments do for us. They give us the ability to indulge in a negative emotion at little or no risk to ourselves. So your brain gets to do the work and reap the benefits with little cost. And therefore, you know, these negative, quote unquote, but essential emotional states are experienced and make our brain just generally better and healthier. And it recognizes that, hence we keep coming back.
So kind of related to that, sometimes feeling a strong emotion can have an effect on our thinking. So I think most people will have experienced something like this, though, if they get angry and they do something out of character or something silly. So what do we know about what's going on there? You know, do we know what's happening in the brain when that sort of thing happens?
Yeah, I think I always said, like, you know, emotions and thought aren't necessarily that separate, but there's a degree of, you know, separation that some parts handle the emotional bits and some parts handle the cognitive and rational bits. And you know, the brain has lots of things going on at any one time, and there's lots of different things which you know, affect this. But what it boils down to ultimately is that the brain has limited resources. You know, it's a very extremely powerful organ, and it's really capable, but it can only do so much with, you know, within the limits of biology and physics. So, you know, our brain's got like, it can do any number of dozens of things, but it can't do them all at once. And like this is the famous statistic that we only use 10% of our brain, which isn't true because we don't, you know, the brain's such a demanded organ. It uses up like 33% of our body's ready fuel just by existing. So if we didn't need it, we wouldn't have it. You know, all of it's useful, but it's also, so we use like 100% of our brain. So 10% is wrong, but also, it's also an overestimate in that we can't deliberately activate 10% at once. It's more like we can only like fire up 3% of the brain in terms of different regions at any one time before the available resources get maxed out. So when you are, you know, cognitive thought and rational thinking and logic is a neurologically demanding process. It's very complex. It's very intricate. It's very, a lot of information is being handled and processed and calculated, which requires resources. So when you're looking at neutral state, if there is such a thing, it depends on, you know, who you ask about that, your brain has the resources available. Like, okay, I'm going to sit here and think calmly about this thing. I'm going to go through that. I'm going to assess the situation and make my decision according to the available data. But when something happens, put you in a strong emotional state, your brain's resources are being diverted to the parts of the brain which cause that state to exist. And it might think that's an essential thing to do because of something that's happened. Like a lot of it's instinctive and reflexive, so you don't have much choice. It's the emotions happen faster than rational thought because they're a more direct, simple process. But then your brain doesn't have as much resources available to direct to the rational thinking part of your brain, which would normally be used to put a lid on the emotions or to keep them under control. So it's like, you know, if you think of like the rational part of your brain as got the lead and the emotion part is a really big dog, sometimes like the dog gets bigger and stronger and then you don't have the physical ability to restrain it. So it goes off, you know, or pulls you too far one direction. And it's got to get tired out before you come back to it. So sometimes you're in an emotional state and you can't think clearly. But if you do just enough to separate yourself from the situation and you calm down and come back to it, then you can think clearly because your brain's worked through the powerful emotion. And now it has resources available again to let rational thought retake control. So it's a lot of it's based on what our brain is capable of doing at any one time, and the fact that emotions happen faster, so they tend to get in there first. They get in the early doors. They grab the good seats before the waiter's ready, and then you have to make do with what's left. And emotions can distort or downplay or suppress rational thinking that way, because when they're strong and powerful and instinctive, the brain has less fuel available or less resources to direct to rational thought to counteract it.
So another important role emotions play in our lives is in feelings of empathy. So what's going on, you know, when we feel empathy? I mean, why do we even feel it? And is it always a good thing?
Yeah, empathy is one of those, I wouldn't say it's uniquely human, but it's an incredibly important part of the human experience. Like, so much of our emotional state and emotional experience is contingent on the feelings of others. And we have emotions and we feel them, but so much of the whole process involved in expressing them, which means we want to share them with others or tell other people how we're feeling. It's like half the whole deal of emotions is putting them out there. When we talk about facial expressions, the only reason that would make any sense is if declaring our emotions to the wider world and to those people in it had an evolutionary role. And that's sort of how we work, because we're such a social communicative species. We actually, you know, we communicate on a subconscious level more often than not, if anything, because we do have this need to constantly be in contact with our fellow human. Like, isolation, like solitary confinement, is a recognized form of torture for a reason, because it's like being deprived of your senses in some respect. Like, you can't, you don't know what's going on. Your brain doesn't handle complete isolation very well at all, which is arguably why lockdown is such a big, heavy mental burden for so many people, because they're, you know, deprived of sort of one thing all humans tend to need, or all 99.9%. There are obviously exceptions to that rule, as always the case. But yeah, so empathy allows us to connect with other people and form a group, a community, far more effectively and far more rapidly than, you know, conscious speaking, like talking to each other and trying to convince someone else that this is what I think, or this is what I think. And no, that's a more long-winded process. Just by recognizing someone's emotional state and sharing it, forms these bonds much faster and communicates things a lot more efficiently and quickly than logical speech or like text-based conversations. So it's really good in that respect. And it helps us understand things a lot more. You know, if someone, a crowd of people run around the corner, like running, like in a sort of apocalypse film, you think, oh, a lot of scared people. That's really bad. I'm scared too. And then you join in and run. And again, it's an obvious survival trait to endure, just to share the feelings of those around you. And obviously it's a good thing in that it's got us to this point. It kept us alive and made us the most dominant species. Our ability to connect and interact is heavily empathy based, but also there are downsides now, particularly in the more common modern world. So, you know, like I say, there are times when you experience emotion, it makes, you know, impinges on your ability to think rationally. And if you're around other people who are all experiencing a strong emotion, you're likely to experience it too, thanks to empathy, and that'll color or cloud your own ability to think normally. That's where you get things like mob mentality. You're in the middle of a highly aroused, angry crowd, and they start doing things which are like emotionally charged. If you're in amongst that, you usually can't help it. Empathy, your empathy systems kick in. You detect, right, everyone else is angry. I don't want to stand out, so I'm going to be angry as well about the external thing which you're all angry at. And I'm going to behave in ways which I wouldn't normally. So that's where you get people who, in the middle of riots, will cause property damage or do things that are really dangerous or damage and get arrested. And they wouldn't normally ever do that. But when they're surrounded by other people who are doing that, they, you know, their brains work differently. It's a process called de-individuation. And we lose our sense of self to a certain extent because the empathy or the emotional contagion is what it's called, if you can't pin it on one specific person, that overwhelms us and becomes something which dominates our actions. And oftentimes, not for the best.
So we've covered an awful lot there. I just think, sort of by way of closing, you know, what have you learned about dealing with your own emotions and regulating your own emotions, etc., while you were writing and researching the book, just as a way of summing up?
Yeah, I think I've learned that emotions are really important, way more important than I ever give them credit for. Even like in most of the scientific field, like they are, you know, oftentimes just an afterthought or just acknowledge that they're there, but you know, you don't focus on them. But they affect so much of who we are, what we do. I think everything we think and do and feel is influenced or at least impacted on or caused directly by our emotional state. And so we need to suppress them. There are obviously instances when you should maybe not suppress completely, but to keep them under control or like not act on them. Mm. But the whole bottling up thing, like, and I don't just mean, you know, the masculine stoic must not show emotions thing. Even things like, you know, the positivity movement, like you must be happy at all times. You can choose to be happy, choose your attitude. Those are just another way of bottling up. As in, like, you have a negative emotion, that's wrong. Don't do that. Force yourself to have a different emotion. That's just as unhelpful as saying, you know, must not suppress, must not show emotion. Just show, if anything, something my research says that showing a different emotion than when you're feeling can be more stressful. It may cause more damage overall than just not showing anything. Because obviously you're activating more parts of your brain which don't want to be activated at this particular point. And that's, you know, that's unhelpful. So I would say what I've learned mostly is don't try and suppress your emotions if you don't have to. Let them happen. They are valid and they are essential. There'll be times when you don't have a choice, but you know, try and get around to it later. But yeah, I think the idea that you have to be rational and logical at all times, it's not only impractical, it's incorrect. I think also I would say it's impossible because emotions influence way too much of our thoughts. They are like the cement which holds the bricks of our mind together. And the idea that you can just suppress them or get rid of them is both wrong and unhelpful.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Instant Genius. That was Dr. Dean Burnett. To read more about the fascinating neuroscience of emotions, check out his book, Emotional Ignorance. The current issue of BBC Science Focus magazine is out now. Pick up a copy wherever you buy your favourite magazines or visit sciencefocus.com.